thanking the organizers for inviting me to present the results of a project that we have started with John Toth in 2001. I will be discussing results we have gotten with John Toth and also with two graduates. Actually, Derek Chang was an undergraduate student. He wrote his honors thesis on the numerics on Heisenberg manifolds, and Mata Khosravi is finishing her PhD thesis on Weyl's law for Heisenberg manifolds during the current or next academic year. Okay, so let me start first of all with with some generalities about what is the Heisenberg group. Oh, I want that higher. Then I will talk about Heisenberg manifolds. In particular, why do we care? The third part will be about Weyl's law in general. And then maybe here I will include also the results and also some conjectures and maybe some numerical results as well. So, first part, the Heisenberg group. The Heisenberg group of dimension 2n plus 1 is a set of matrices 1, x, t, 0, 1, y, 0, 0, 1, where x and y are vectors in Rn and t is a real number. And it is in fact an nilpotent group. And the reason why we call it Heisenberg group is because if we look at the Lie algebra of it, that consists of matrices of the form, well, it's nilpotent matrices now, again of the same form x, y, and t, with x and y in Rn, and t a real number. In this case, for this Lie algebra, we can take a basis, basically taking the various bases for Rn here, here, and one basis element there. So the basis element xi we'll use for the Lie algebra 0 here, the basis vector ei 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. The yi's, there will be 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, ei 0, 0, 0. And there is one extra basis element, call it z, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. And the commutation relation between the basis for the Lie algebra is exactly the commutation relations for positions and momenta in quantum mechanics. So that's why we call it the Heisenberg group. It has been extensively studied in the literature, particularly in the framework of partial differential operators relating to the Heisenberg group and also with relation with CR manifolds. This is a particularly fruitful field that people have worked on in Toronto, like Peter Greiner, if he was around here. But I don't want to talk about it because I want to talk about Heisenberg manifolds, which are quotients of this group. So they look like Hn divided by gamma, where gamma is a discrete subgroup. And it also happens that I will only be talking about compact quotients. Of what? Okay, actually, the way that I have this matrix here is of dimension n plus 2 times n plus 2. And this one, so in the simplest case, you take n equals 1, and we're talking about 3 by 3 matrices. Okay?
Matrix
Okay. In fact, to simplify things, in most of my talk, I'm going to talk only about 3x3 matrices where x, y, and t are real numbers. So you don't have to worry much about it. Okay? And in fact, that's where we started with our research. So, first of all, why do we care about Heisenberg manifolds? The first reason is because they're completely integrable systems. This is, in fact, the theorem of Leo Butler in his thesis from Queen's University about year 2000 or 2001. And it has a very interesting story, this theorem, because there is a theorem of Taimanov that describes relations so that the integrals that you can use for integrability are, in fact, real analytic functions. And there are some obstructions on being on integrable with real analytic integrals, and the obstructions exactly happen in the case of an nilpotent group like Hn. So consequently, it is completely integrable that one of the integrals is C infinity and cannot be taken to be a real analytic. The second reason, I don't want to talk much about it, well, basically that we have as many functions as the dimension of the manifold so that the Poisson commutes. No. Well, I haven't discussed the metric yet, okay? So I'll have to come into that. Maybe I should discuss the metric right now. Okay, so let's discuss the metric. This group, Hn, has lots of automorphisms, inner and outer automorphisms, and one can actually conjugate a metric that we are going to take in a certain way and get a simplified version of the metric. So the metrics that I'm going to consider are going to be left invariant metrics. So they're going to be metrics that when lifted to the cover, which is Hn, they're going to be left invariant under the whole action of the group. And by using various inner automorphisms, we can assume that the Lie algebra can, in fact, be split as an R to N with the center here, where the center is the matrices I have described, 0, T, 0, 0, 0, 0, and R to N corresponds to the identification of the Lie algebra with the vector fields xi and yi, I equals 1 up to n. And then the metric will have a relatively simple form. It will be an n by n matrix here, n by n, or hold on, n equals 1, 2 by 2, 2n by 2n here. And then there will be also zeros here. And there will be a constant here, gn, where gn is positive. So we can assume by various automorphisms that actually we make the splitting of the Lie algebra to be an orthogonal splitting with respect to the left invariant metric. Now, more reasons why we like Heisenberg manifolds. I will mention as the second reason, the one that I don't want to discuss, although I care much more about it, is that Fourier coefficients of automorphic forms look like integrals of some automorphic form over n divided by gamma choose n, and this thing here is a Heisenberg manifold, or let's say generally a nilpotent manifold. Okay? And that will not play a role in the rest of the discussion that I have. And the third reason we care about Heisenberg manifolds is isospectrality. So one of the problems that has occupied the attention of geometers, spectral theorists for many, many years is the construction of manifolds that have the same spectrum without being isometric. And Heisenberg manifolds, because of the rich structure in terms of groups, essentially because the group of outer automorphisms is rather rich, have been studied in particular for the issue of isospectrality. And let me mention the results of Gordon and Wilson, and consequently results of Gordon, Gornet, other people involved are Webb, etc., etc. And just one result, for n equals 1, if Hn mod gamma with a metric here, actually would be H1, is isometric to H1 mod gamma prime with another metric, then the metric and the group are determined. So G, comma, gamma are determined. So in dimension 3, the spectrum actually determines the metric as long as we are in the category of Heisenberg manifolds. But it is not true if n is bigger than 1. And in fact, the case n bigger than 1 attracted the most attention because in this case, Gordon, Wilson, and other people were able to construct, in fact, families of metrics that are, in fact, isospectral. Double tilde, where is the double tilde? Well, if they are isospectral here. And what was the second question? Oh, okay. So, if n is bigger than 1, one would have families of matrix GT, so that Hn divided by gamma are all isospectral. But not isometric. One should mention here also a paper of Hubert Pesch, who developed a particular case of the Poisson summation formula, essentially using the heat kernel, to reprove the results of Gordon and Wilson. That was in Duke about 1985. Okay. Now, since I'm talking about the spectrum of Heisenberg manifolds, I should also probably tell you a little bit what we know about the spectrum. So first, what does it mean? Well, basically it means that up to an inner automorphism of the group H1, you can determine what the group gamma is, and you can determine what the metric G is. The first thing one should know about Heisenberg manifolds is that, in fact, they are fiber bundles. So Hn is, in fact, there is a base manifold, which is a torus, and there is a fiber, which is, in fact, S1. And roughly speaking, the torus that we are going to see comes out of the variables x and y, and we are dividing by a group, so we have R to N, and we're dividing by this discrete group of R to N, and we get a torus, so we have a lattice there. And the S1 corresponds into the third variable, the T that I have there. So that's roughly speaking what is happening. Now, if you want, I could even write down a particular case of the Laplace operator, although it is not very, how should I put it, enlightening to see the form of the Laplace operator. So, in the case where we take the metric in three dimensions to be 1, 1, 1, so the identity matrix at the identity element of the group, so on the Lie algebra, which is the tangent space, to be this one here, then we can write the Laplace operator to be ddz squared plus d squared dx squared plus ddy plus x d dz all that square. And then you can actually calculate the spectrum based on this notion here, and we can see that the spectrum is going to take into account two parts. There will be one part of the spectrum that comes out of this torus that I have here, and there will be some other part of the spectrum which will be, let's say, more complicated, but it is in fact the most interesting part of the spectrum. And however, for the results that I'm going to mention later, one should not just say, okay, this is the interesting part of the spectrum, the torus spectrum is not important. Actually, it is important at any stage. So, first of all, maybe I should describe what is the form of the discrete subgroups that we are going to have. So maybe for simplicity right now, let me concentrate on the case n equals 1 as I've promised, because this will show most of the features which are interesting. So n equals 1, and gamma will be a subgroup of the form 1, x, t, y, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. And here x will be R in the ring R times Z, Y will be another integer, and T will be another integer. Now, of course, this is one example of a discrete subgroup of H1, but in fact it can be proved that up to conjugation, again, inner automorphisms, this classifies all discrete subgroups in the case of a three-dimensional Heisenberg group. Just a fixed number. What? It doesn't have to be positive, but just any number, fix a number. Okay? Yeah, zero would be kind of bad. Yeah. Okay, so let me now describe what the spectrum is going to be. And maybe I should mention three groups of people that have done calculations on the spectrum of Heisenberg manifolds. The first group is Sinkhoff and Denninger. The second group, this was essentially for the metric 111. The second group for all metrics and for all discrete groups, etc., it has been done by Gordon and Wilson. And apparently there is also a paper of Colin de Verdier. And the spectrum consists of what I call type 1 eigenvalues, and those are torus eigenvalues corresponding to the torus T, I suppose I'm in two dimensions in this case, with the matrix H that I have described. H is essentially a 2x2 matrix in this case. So we have a 2x2 positive definite matrix that gives us a metric in R2, and we have T2 to be R2 divided by the integer coefficient that we have here. And in this case, we know the eigenvalues to be essentially 4 pi square length square, where L is in the dual lattice, duality determined by the metric H. And the eigenvalues are, of course, the eigenfunctions, the standard exponentials we know. Type 2 eigenvalues. Mu, c, comma, k. C and k are integers, in fact, let's say positive integers or non-negative integers. And they have a particular form, 4 pi square, c squared divided by g, whatever I've named it there, g1, plus 2 pi, a certain number, d1 square, c times 2k plus 1, where D1 is determined by the metric explicitly. And now every eigenvalue here, for good or for bad, comes with relatively high multiplicity. So with multiplicity, 2 times C times, in fact, R. So once I have fixed the number R there, essentially the multiplicity is determined by the integer C. What? G1? G1 is this coefficient here in the metric. Okay? So I'm concentrating only in three dimensions. There are formulas in all dimensions and for all discrete groups, for all things that you could take. Not quite, but anyway, so let's take it to be an integer. Okay. In the simplest case, where we take the matrix to be 1, 1, and 2 pi, then we can get a little bit of information out of this formula here. We divide with 2 pi here, so we have 2 pi. We can factor a c, and we have c plus 2k plus 1. So those will be the eigenvalues of the second type, which are important. And if you want, you can even ignore this constant 2 pi. And we see that the eigenvalues are given by an indefinite quadratic form. Now, I suppose my title is Weyl's Law on Heisenberg Manifold, so I have to tell you what Weyl's Law is if you do not know. So, Weyl's Law in general. We define the spectral counting function. We count the number of eigenvalues less than or equal to lambda. And we have Weyl's Law improved by Shermander that tells me the main term in the asymptotics is a constant depending on the dimension of the manifold times the volume of the manifold times lambda to the n over 2 plus an error term, which I will denote r of lambda. And Shermander's theorem tells me that r of lambda is going to be big O of lambda to the n minus 1 over 2. So my talk essentially is about what we can say about the remainder term in Weyl's Law for Heisenberg manifolds. What are bounds that we can prove, and what are bounds that we can conjecture? Okay. Now, some more things that we can say about this situation is that we see immediately from the discussion up there that we have the torus eigenvalues, which is a lattice counting problem, and there are, of course, the indefinite quadratic form here, and that, as I will explain, corresponds to another lattice counting problem, and that reminds us of a theorem of Colin-de-Verdier on quantum integrable systems that basically tells us that if the system is quantum integrable up to a shift and for certain profile curve, which might be relatively difficult to determine, we can essentially do the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization and get that the eigenvalues are in fact values of some function on a certain lattice. What we don't have here, it doesn't mean that it's not true. Apparently, no one has proved it. No one has proved that, in fact, Heisenberg manifolds are quantum integrable. Presumably, they are, but I don't know. No, this is for general Riemannian manifolds. So in our case, maybe, So if we use this thing here, which is the case that we have, so H has dimension 2n plus 1, so we will have here n plus a half, and Shermander's bound just basically cuts half a power from that, and in this case, Shermander's theorem will give you to the n. And the question is, whether we can improve this thing or not. Now, improvements on Shermander's theorem is a subject that has a long history, including Deustermann and Guilleman's theorem, for compact manifolds at least, for manifolds with boundary. Victor probably knows more than anyone else. You can improve to a small o of lambda to the n here if you have generic assumptions on the geodesic flow on the Riemannian manifold, and those generic assumptions are satisfied because the Heisenberg manifolds are in fact integrable in a non-degenerate sense.
There are, for some manifolds,
Yes. Yes. Okay. In fact, actually, yeah, question? Volume of HN. Well, the volume, first of all, depends on the group. There is a formula for it. What's the formula exactly? What you have to do is that you have to take the square root of the determinant of this matrix, I think, multiply also with GN, and multiply with something that tells you how big the discrete subgroup is. It's an explicit formula, fairly easy to compute. You can find it in Gordon and Wilson's paper. Okay. After one has computed what the eigenvalues are, and before we get to Weyl's law, one could ask about other interesting questions for Heisenberg manifolds, like, can we compute the Heet kernel? This has been done. Can we compute the spectral zeta function and the determinant of the Laplace operator for those things? And there is a recent paper of Furutani and Serge de Gosson in a Journal of Geometry and Physics 2003, in which they actually compute the determinant of the Laplacian for such manifolds. I will not go into that. Now, this might be a good point to show some transparencies. So as we already have discussed, it plays a role, a certain torus plays a role in the discussion. So let's remind ourselves of the classical Gauss circle problem, which is asking to count the number of lattice points inside a circle of radius r. And the transparency that I have here is essentially also the proof of the Gauss theorem that we can bound the error term by a power. So if the radius here is r, the number of lattice points is the area of the circle times times r square, and then the trivial bound is in fact a single power of r. And the classical Gauss problem is to improve as much as you can the bound for the lattice points, the error term in this problem here. The conjecture should be r to the 1/2, the way that I have normalized things. In fact, the same problem can be stated for the more general lattice that I was discussing, so that leads basically to the standard lattice and an ellipse. Here I have, in fact, the ellipse even shifted, but that doesn't seem to play a role in the rest of my discussion. The third lattice problem that I would like to discuss is something that people in analysis and PDEs have not thought so much as people in number theory. This is called the Dirichlet divisor problem. So what we have here is a standard hyperbola, x times y equals to a certain number, and you're asking in the first quadrant how many lattice points you have below this hyperbola here. It is not difficult to see that this is equivalent to the average order of growth of the number of divisors of a number. And actually, this problem is much more related to the things that I'm going to discuss. So what is the situation that we have to deal with? Remember that in the formula that I have listed up there, I have essentially said that the eigenvalues are C times C plus 2K plus 1. And C and 2K and K are integers, so they're basically of the form C times a number, let's say X, integer, where X is bigger than C. And because you're adding here 2k plus 1, you're insisting that those integers c and x have different parity. So to do the counting in this situation, what we have to do is consider the standard lattice, consider the hyperbola, but also one needs to consider this line here, y equals x, and count the lattice points below both the hyperbola and this line here. But because the eigenvalues have multiplicities, every one of those lattice points here has to be taken with appropriate multiplicity, which I said it was 2 times c, essentially. Well, that's not actually quite right. That's one of the lattices that one needs to consider. If we did not have a parity assumption on c and x here, so we said that c and x should not have the same parity, If we didn't have the assumption, that would have been correct. Because we have this assumption, you have to do the lattice counting problem here with weights, and then take out the contribution from another lattice, which is the lattice where the coordinates are congruent to each other. So here is the line, here is the hyperbola, and now you count those lattice points here with weights. And if you look, for instance, this lattice point has coordinates 1 and 3, which have the same parity. This one has coordinates, let's say here, 4 and 2, which have the same parity, etc. So you have to do two lattice counting problems here. And now you may ask what we can say about the error term in Weyl's law concerning the lattice points that I have already showed you, the classical Gauss problem, the Dirichlet divisor problem, and those two lattice counting problems that I've discussed here. So let me show you some transparencies. First of all, the conjecture of Gauss. Well, if we look at, let's say, Weyl's law for a torus of dimension 2, then the main term grows like x. The error term by Hermander is x to the half. The conjecture of Gauss is that it should grow like x to the 1/4 plus epsilon. So what we have graphed here, in fact, those graphs are due to Derek Chang, is that we have the error term in the Gauss circle problem, and we have normalized the error term by dividing by the expected order of growth, which is x to the 1/4, and plot the function that we see, and this is what we see. And it seems sort of pretty much bounded between minus 8 and 6. Of course, we know it's not exactly bounded because we are missing some powers of logarithms, but powers of logarithms will probably not show in graphics that go up to 200,000, let's say, for the radius of the circle. Okay, so this is the Gauss circle problem. Yeah? No. I mean, this is the expected, the correct one. So I don't have actually a marker with me. Okay, so let me write the correct thing here. So for the Gauss circle problem, the way that I have noticed thing n of x should go like pi times x, the error term r of x. You can easily bound it by x to the 1/2, and then you want to prove the conjecture, which is due to Hardy, is x to the 1/4 plus epsilon. Okay? And that's a very difficult problem. Here is the absolute error term in the Dirichlet divisor problem. So you take out the main term that you have in that problem, and you see that, in fact, the error increases. And you may ask what kind of conjecture you can make. And in fact, it's the same conjecture as in the Gauss circle problem. It's x to the 1/4. And when you look at this graph again, well, things seem to be fairly consistent. The normalized error term seems to be bounded between minus 4 and 6. Here is the absolute error term when we take the lattice that I was discussing. So we are taking the points below the hyperbola and the line with weights. And this is how the error term behaves. I didn't normalize here, so you may ask, what should be the correct normalization and what should be the correct conjecture? So here I take the error term. I divide by x to the 3/4, and as you see, it seems sort of bounded between minus 1 and 1. So it seems, at least numerically, that the correct order of growth will be t to the 3/4 plus epsilon. And in fact, we have experimented with seeing the graph if you use different exponents here instead of 3/4, and you definitely do not see such a nice picture. You get things that either increase or go down to 0. But of course, this is in no way a proof. If we look at the other lattice that I showed you, the lattice where the coordinates are basically having the same parity, and you look at the normalized error term, again x to the 3/4, seems to be okay again. And I'll stop the numerics right now to tell you what are the theorems. because the problem with using transparency is that you never know afterwards where they are and where your knots are. Okay. So, theorem one, this is P and Toth, and also Chang, P and Toth. So this was in Journal of Differential Geometry 2002, and this is 2003 in Bonner Mathematische Schriften. This is where you put things when you're also supporting other institutes far away from here. And let me mention the best result that we have in this case. So we are discussing the case of H1, so we are in three dimensions, and we can bound the remainder term by lambda to the 34th over 41, exactly, without plus epsilon. And in fact, we have a technique which this is sort of, let's say, a corollary. This is not the real theorem. The real theorem is that if L, K are an exponent pair, whatever that means, I really don't want to discuss it in this audience, then R of lambda is big O lambda to the L plus 2K plus 1 divided by 2K plus 2. Okay. And let me now tell you that although I will not discuss what is an exponent pair, there are conjectures on what are the best exponent pairs that exist. Oh, there are some cancellations. And also the L and the K here are complicated numbers. So they are not integers, they are just rational numbers. So there is a conjecture due to Montgomery that tells you that for every epsilon positive, epsilon comma 1/2 plus epsilon is an exponent pair. And consequently, this conjecture here will imply that the error term for the Heisenberg manifold of dimension 3 is bounded by lambda to the 3/4 plus epsilon. Also, it happens that the Montgomery conjecture will imply the best thing in the Gauss circle problem. So it will imply in the Gauss circle problem that R of X is big O of X to the 1/4 plus epsilon. And it will imply lots of other interesting things in number theory, including the Lindelof hypothesis and things like that. Consequently, it's a deep conjecture, difficult to prove, and I do not have any expectation of seeing this conjecture proved very soon. However, it's one of those test cases where if you have well-standardized conjectures, you could see how far they take you in your actual problem. Epsilon.
Yes.
You really want to hear about all the progress in analytic number theory using van der Kolk's method? Okay. So it has to do with exponential sounds. And exponential sounds play a role in all those problems, the Gauss circle problem, the divisor problem, the Heisenberg problem, etc., etc. And what we want to essentially bound are sums of the form e to the 2 pi I fn, where n, let's say, belong in the range from capital N to capital N times 2. And here Fn will be a function which, in fact, is a, how should I put it? It's not flat. I mean, it's one of the cases where we can apply stationary phase. And the kind of functions that one is interested in, actually, so the functions f of x will be such that the derivative, in some sort of nice way, can be approximated by a number times x to the minus s, for some number s and for some number t. So for this range, the estimate for exponential sums, okay, an exponent pair will be in fact exactly the following thing, t n to the minus s to the power k n to the power l plus t inverse n to the power s. Okay? So if for a certain set of functions that are allowed in this case and include, let's say, profiles of a circle, profile of the hyperbola and things like that, we can bound in terms of the, you know, the function determines the t and the s here, and if we have that for all this set of functions and for the pair k, l, we have this kind of estimate, then we say that these numbers l and k form an exponent pair. Okay. Now, what is the evidence for this conjecture? Well, I mean, the conjecture, not the exponent pair conjecture, the conjecture that we have, that now the error term should grow like lambda to the 3/4. What? The formulas that I have here. Yeah, there are different formulas, but in fact they have the same main characteristic. They involve some sort of exponential sum with different phase functions, different, phase functions. This one here is for the Heisenberg. And this one here is for the Gauss circle problem. Now, evidence. The first evidence is Kostravitz thesis. Let's put 2004 here. So, we are trying to get a bound, let's say an L infinity bound on the remainder term. If you can't get something for every individual lambda, maybe you could get something on average. And the result is as follows. So we are going to square the error term and integrate it for a range of spectral parameter, let's say from 0 to t. So let's start thinking. In principle, we know that R of lambda should behave like lambda to the 3/4. So if you square it, you get lambda to the 3/2. You integrate from 0 to t, so you should be getting t to the 5/2. So I'm going to divide in front by t to the 5/2, and then try to see whether I can take the limit as t goes to infinity. And the limit exists. And even more surprising, it is a positive constant that has been explicitly computed in Kostravitz thesis. So that's a good evidence. A result of this type comes under the name Cramer's formula, because Cramer was the guy that proved similar formulas for the case of the Gauss circle problem and the Dirichlet divisor problem. Okay. Second result, which we have done with Toth in our JDG paper, is that instead of averaging over the spectral range, Mata, is there a mistake? Yeah. Okay. I always confuse things like that. Okay. But the theorem is correct? Okay. So, instead of averaging over the spectral range, you can start thinking whether you could average over families of metrics. And you can actually do that, although this doesn't quite give the same kind of strong evidence. So we will have, let's say, the error term depending on a parameter u. So those are parameters. And the parameters are essentially parameters of the metric, either on the torus that we have, the quadratic form we put on the torus, or in the G component that we had. And we could square the error term and integrate over the parameter space, and we get upper bounds which are consistent with what our conjecture lambda to the 3/4 gives. We get lambda to the 3/2 plus epsilon because we have actually squared. And there are also lower bounds, but those are also lower spectral bounds. So we fix a particular Heisenberg metric, we take the square, and we integrate, let's say, from capital T to capital 2T, and divide with 1 over T. And how should that go? Yeah, you're right. You should be the lambda. And the result here is, in fact, T, in fact, to the 3/4, as it should be. Okay? This last thing here actually is interesting because this is where we use the Doester-McGilliman formula concentrated on one of the closed periods different from zero. And in this case, what are you looking at? The what? Oh, what are they doing up there? Okay. Three halves, of course. Well, okay. Let's put 3/4 and let's erase this thing. Okay. So this uses the Doester-McGilliman formula concentrated to a non-trivial period. So one needs actually to analyze the geodesic flow on a Heisenberg manifold with any one of those left invariant metrics, and one actually finds that the period set could be a four-dimensional manifold in the six-dimensional cotangent space. So that's kind of nice. And then, of course, one can ask, what happens in higher-dimensional Heisenberg manifolds? So usually you expect that similar results will hold. So you give this problem to your graduate student, Mata Khosravi, and you expect that a year or so later she'll come with similar results. But then we have surprises. And here are the surprises that she has introduced. Okay, so let's first of all restate here Fermander's theorem for these things. So R of lambda is big O of lambda to the n. I remind you that, of course, the main term in this case is a constant times lambda to the n plus 1/2. And what happens for higher dimensional Heisenberg manifolds is that there is a distinction, there is a splitting in two cases. The case that I would consider arithmetic and the case that I would consider non-arithmetic. So there are some constants that can be computed, essentially the DIs that I was talking about before. So we have the numbers D1, D2, all the way up to Dn. And what could happen is that the di squares over dj squares are, let's say, rational numbers. This case I would consider to be arithmetic. Or it could be the case that one of those quotients is, in fact, an irrational number. And here are the results in Khosravi's thesis. In the arithmetic case, we can actually prove that the error term, you can cut, in fact, a power 1 over 6, and assuming the conjecture of Montgomery, actually you can cut a power 1/4 plus epsilon. So this result here is conditional. and the result is in the non-arithmetic case, we have a generic result depending on the Diophantine properties of that quotient of numbers which is irrational, because we are in the second case. So in that case, we actually get the best result that one would expect. So you cut 1/4 power as it should be. Now, what? Oh, in the arithmetic case, this is conditional on the Montgomery conjecture. In the non-arithmetic case, and for a generic metric that you can put, it is provable. Okay. Now you may ask, what is there to be done more on the error term for Heisenberg manifolds? Well, people that have been following the literature in the Gauss circle problem and the Dirichlet divisor problem know that they're in fact distribution functions for error terms, yes? No, it's the standard Diophantine conditions that for almost all irrationals, you know how close an integer times this irrational gets to the integers. Yeah. No, okay, the arithmetic case is when all of them are rational. The non-arithmetic is if one of them is irrational. If there are more of them, I don't know whether I could get anything else. Okay, we should definitely talk about it. I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to.
There is a book which I never saw it, so I just got reference that if you have the few irrational numbers.
How you can do simultaneous Diophantine approximation? Oh, yeah, yeah. Those things I know, but they don't seem to play a role. I just don't know. So, what? Other question? Oh, this thing. Yeah, okay. So, yes, yes, I can see it. But no one tells you how to switch that thing off. Okay. So, here is the situation with the Gauss circle problem. So what we have done is that you take this remainder term, you divide by the expected order of growth, and then you ask how many of those numbers lie in the range between 0 and 0.1, 0.1 and 0.2, and you get this kind of distribution function here. And actually, it is not centered at 0, and it is not, in fact, Gaussian if you worry about it. It is probably non-Gaussian because the tails of the distribution you get behave like at least e to the minus x to the fourth. And actually, this is a difficult theorem to prove, particularly for the case of the classical Gauss circle problem, and it is a slightly easier to prove for the case of a generic ellipse. Okay? For the, no, this was known to Heath Brown much before. You could ask about what happens with the Dirichlet divisor problem, and here is the distribution you get in that case. This is also probably not Gaussian. This is, I think, due to Heath Brown as well. Okay, so we have normalized the error term. So we have the error term and we divide by the expected order of growth. So in this case, it is r of x divided by x to the 1/4. And this is a bunch of numbers in the range of eigenvalues you're going to work with. Okay? And then you're going to classify those numbers depending on where they belong. Do they belong in 0 to 0.1, 0.1 to 0.2, and on the other axis, how many times you get the occurrence of that? I have not normalized to get a probability distribution. So we've got a number of r of x divided by x to the 1/4 to be very close to 0, almost, let's say, 8,000 times. And if we have a big gap, let's say, close to 4, that happens very few times. Okay? And that's the kind of distribution graph that we get. And you can ask whether we get distribution things also for the case of Heisenberg manifolds. And here is the graph for the first lattice counting problem that I have described. So this is when you take all lattice points below the hyperbola and the line y equals x. And if you want, here is what happens if you take the other lattice, which was the lattice with the coordinates being having the same parity, and again you seem to be getting a distribution function. So it is more than likely that one has a distribution function for the error term for the Heisenberg manifolds, which reminds us of a theorem of Sinai and Kosygin, who have actually done a similar theorem for the case of Liouville matrix on Torrey. How difficult this will be? Well, I hope that Mata will have that also in her thesis by the time she graduates. Okay, and then she'll have three papers, and once you have done three things, you're out. That's how things work in the US, three strikes and you're out. You're out of graduate school, which is much better than being in prison. Okay, so I think I will stop my talk here. Thank you.